This episode is brought to you by Nyman Ranch. I'm Paul Willis, a fifth-generation farmer and co-founder of Nyman Ranch Pork Company. Learn more about us at NymanRanch.com.
Hi, and welcome to Why Food Podcast, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, and career changers. We're really excited because we're here this week with Joseph Hernandez. He's a freelance editor and writer, formerly of the Chicago Tribune, 750 Daily, Thrillist, and Wine Enthusiast, and also Janet McCracken. She is a freelance editor and recipe developer, and she's the former food director of Rachel Ray Every Day and deputy food editor at Bon Appetit. So welcome, you guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I think it's pretty cool because it's like our first episode since Thanksgiving, which is obviously the most food-centric holiday. So, you know, my co-host, Ethan, he is actually out of the country right now. He's in Armenia sourcing spices for his spice company. You guys can follow along on his adventures on social media at Burlap and Barrel. But I just want to get the episode started with kind of recapping Thanksgiving. Janet, did you make a turkey in the whole dinner this year?
I went to my daughter's house in Portland, Oregon, which is one of the greatest cities we have to visit. I'm so grateful she lives there because I get to go there and hang out. And we did everything. We did vegetables, salads, appetizers.
Any pies?
Oh, yes.
Very important question.
Oh, yes, pies. Always, always pies.
What kind? Did you make any pies?
I did. I made an apple crostata with a halva crumble. It was very nice.
Halva is very in right now. It's I'm seeing a lot of desserts.
It's
interesting.
It's yeah, exactly. I think it's a really delicious addition. It's like that crumbly and the sweet and the sesame. It's really nice. And then, but the best moment I think of Thanksgiving, best slash worst, was when the rest of the family was staying at an Airbnb, and we get a text at 9 o'clock in the morning from my daughter, my oven isn't working. But somehow they have a Komodo in the backyard, you know, where those kind of green eggs
things. Oh, yeah.
And so they were going to smoke a turkey anyway. So they smoked a turkey, brought that out much earlier than they intended, put another turkey in because we were going to do two. And then I did a whole bunch of stuff at the Airbnb because the oven there worked, thank God. And it all...
And you guys saved Thanksgiving.
It all worked.
Really I love lucky. It. Yes. I love it. What about you, Joseph? Were you in the city this year?
Yeah, I was in the city.
Okay.
Didn't travel, which, thank God, because I've been traveling 2 or 3 times a month since January. So
wow.
Finally decided to settle in and keep quiet and lay low. Had a very small gathering at home. I baked hand pies instead of pies. Because I love pie for breakfast. So it was my selfish excuse to be, you know, let me just make some stuff that I'm going to like. So I made cranberry pies and apple hand pies.
Pies are the best breakfast.
Best breakfast.
The best.
Yeah.
Agreed. With a cup of coffee, please.
Yeah.
I don't even need an excuse to have pie for breakfast.
And, you know, hand pies are just a little bit more mobile. Like, I was able to take them out and go take a walk in the morning and have a cup of coffee while walking. And yeah,
I love it. It's like a fancy Pop-Tart, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So what's really cool about you guys, I'm really excited that you're on the show today because I think... We often on this show kind of talk about why people got into the food industry. And I do want to, you know, take a few minutes and kind of talk through each of your journeys. But I think what's more interesting is, you know, we're in this changing landscape in food media. And I think we're all journalists and storytellers of sorts, and food is the medium. But what is keeping us in food? Like, why do you feel tied to food, Janet, even though the landscape seems to be, in a way, saturated, but the purse strings also seem to be getting tighter and tighter?
Yeah, it's gotten so open. There's so much happening. It can be hard to kind of find a place to fit in and to focus in on. You know, I've been in magazines now for like 16 years, and I have loved every moment of working in magazines. I think it's just so much fun and so creative and challenging. But I also, at this point, I don't know if that's where I want to stay. It's kind of sad to you know, the evolution of the magazine is not going in a very positive direction right now. And I think, you know, hopefully things will settle down and that they will come back, because I think magazines are so fun and tactile, the tactile experience.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I personally love magazines, and I'm realizing I should subscribe to more if I want to continue to see them. And, you know, it is interesting because what you said about, you know, it's very open right now. I think that the traditional kind of pathways into journalism, be it food journalism or any other kind of journalism, they are changing. And, you know, we're in the age of the celebrity chef that can get a magazine, or just the celebrity house remodeler that can get a magazine, right? But we also are in an age of a lot of wonderful independent magazines that are popping up, where, you know, anyone with an idea and a successful GoFundMe can essentially start a magazine. And there are some beautiful ones, like Whetstone is really gorgeous. Good Company, which was Grace Bonney's magazine. Beautiful. It was beautiful. I would read those stories and I would ask myself, wow, I didn't need, like, they're the stories I didn't know I was missing. So, you know, it's really interesting to kind of see where this is going to go.
Yes. I you know, it's interesting you brought up those smaller magazines. I think that could be a part of the evolution of magazines. You know, when I was in it, the, you know, our subscriber base was 1.7 million. That's a lot of people. And maybe it's time to start looking at smaller, more niche kind of things, like Lucky Peach was, and many others.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the subscription model, right? Because the magazine that you were at very recently, and you had a big feature that came out this month. Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that feature?
Oh, sure. It was so much fun. Well, you know, every year in a magazine, like Christmas or Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, the holidays come around, and you're like, oh my God, I've been doing this for 17 years and I have to figure out how am I going to tell you how to do Thanksgiving different this year, and how are we going to do this? So this year, in our December holiday story, it was about sort of exponential entertaining. So I did a story, if you're having a party for 4 people, a party if you're having dinner for 8 people, and a party if you're having dinner for 16. And I just, you know, made sure that each one was easy to pull off for any group that you end up having. And it was really fun to do.
Well, that's and you guys can check that out, because it's on newsstands now. And
the last issue, the last subscriber issue of Rachel Ray Every Day.
The
then
last
it goes to
issue.
A new quarterly newsstand.
Yeah, and that's a model that we're also seeing spring up with, like, Savora, for example, and
Magnolia.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Joseph, I know that, you know, your path has been slightly different. You spent quite a while at the Chicago Tribune. That's actually where we met. And then you moved on to Thrillist and 750. You know, so being in, like, actual print paper that's coming out on a much more frequent basis, and then a more digital platforms, how do you see the landscape in those mediums? Where do you see it going?
And oh, God.
Where is it going?
Where's you have the magic ball.
The hardest question. Well, I mean, even my start, I was in, at Wine Enthusiast, I worked both in print and digital, and that was a magazine as well. So I've now worked in magazines, digital, and newspapers, and I've kind of seen a lot of shifts in all of those mediums and all of those forms. You know, it's still hard to wrap my head around how different those schedules were, and how you know.
Tell us, how are they different?
Oh.
For people that might not understand, you know, how far in advance maybe a print magazine is working on a story versus a newspaper versus digital.
Yeah, I mean, with a print product, you're working much further in advance. So, you know, let's say we're now entering the holiday season and you're starting to see those titles kind of publish and be on the newsstands, and they're promoting either Thanksgiving still or Christmas. Those stories and those photo shoots and everything was produced back in July.
I have photos of me doing barbecue grilling in the backyard in a snowstorm with my parka on.
100%. 100%. Yeah. And I've done, you know, I've done that barbecue story in you know, the last snowstorm of February.
Okay. Right? Was that in Chicago when you were in Chicago?
No, that was here when I was at Wine Enthusiast. But but for a newspaper, my calendar ended up being driven by daily, weekly, and monthly stuff. So, you know, we would plan Thanksgiving in September, which is a little bit more doable than, say, you know, August or July. But we were still a little further ahead, but we had to pivot a lot with breaking news or you know, a restaurant opening next week or things like that.
Like that maybe nature. Impeachment proceedings. I can't imagine how this is affecting, like, holiday coverage for everything.
Subscribe to your newspapers because those journalists are doing a lot of work. and digital is just so fluid. You know, it's like, I know that if a freelancer or when I was an editor, if somebody was getting in copy late, I can move to something else that was a little bit more ready to go. Not the best all the time, but especially if something is timely, but you're given a little bit more leeway, depending on what you're covering, that you don't have to publish it today. It can be published in a couple of days.
Right. So they can be a little bit more nimble. Mm-hmm. Yet, you know, we see digital platforms that are also struggling with trying to stay afloat, essentially.
Well, it's the advertising. That's the advertising. That's why magazines fold, because mm-hmm. I think there's just so many places mm-hmm. advertisers can go, and
there's still a perception that being online is not as good as being in print.
Absolutely. And do you agree with that?
No, I think it's BS.
I think you're right. I think it's moving away from print. Mm-hmm. And into digital.
I mean, like, look at Bon Appetit doing such a great job with video and with
their
podcasting.
YouTube stuff.
Yeah. And really finding new ways to kind of diversify their revenue streams. But that's because they've built the prestige around that product. Whereas a lot of other publications still don't know how to market their online presence as, you know, value added.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny you bring up Bon Appetit, because in a way, I think they're almost like the poster child, right,
for what
you
100%.
Mentioned. And then you also look at, like, a BuzzFeed with Tasty mm-hmm. and their videos, and they're certainly getting the eyeballs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do wonder, like, okay, yeah, where is the revenue really coming from in those senses?
Well, you can kind of see, like, who's which products are being used in those in those kinds of videos, you know, those hands and pans videos.
And now they're selling their own line of products that go mm-hmm. with the whole hands and pans.
Right.
It's internal money making.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Like
yeah.
Perfect gift for college students, right?
Right.
But then of course there's like the New York Times cooking, right? Mm-hmm. And they've mastered the subscription model. You know, you get enough people to pay that $5 a month and
yeah. I think that is one of the more exciting models out there right now. Mm-hmm. I think the Los Angeles Times is trying to do that mm-hmm. very thing right now as well. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. you know, you've both entered the freelance world, right? And you know, I was following Joseph's Twitter yesterday. Can you give us your Twitter handle?
Yeah, I'm JoeyBear85.
Okay.
Which is what an old boss called me once, Joey Bear. And it stuck.
I can see how it would. That's sweet.
Can you give us a quick overview about this Twitter thread that was started by a woman who covers theater for the New York Times?
Yeah, so the journalist is Nicole Ceratore. With the New York Times. She covers the theater beat. And I saw her tweet about how hard it is as a critic to say no to things and to constantly participate in the discussion that is her beat, which is theater and theater criticism. And she explained how she sees about 200 shows a year, which is a lot of shows, and how she sometimes feel silenced from complaining about it because it is such a fun job. It is a lot of work, but it is her side gig. I think she has another full-time position somewhere. But she, you know, had mentioned some things about how difficult she finds it to be honest about the difficulty of the work. And I had retweeted it because I feel the same way so much in our space, how hard it is to complain to our friends just about, like, oh, you know, I've been eating for ages. I've been traveling. I've been on the road all this time. And yes, it's fun, but it is a lot of work. You know, I mentioned that I had been traveling 2 or 3 times a month for days at a time since January. And, like, that throws me off my routine. Like, I'm in great cities. I'm meeting great people. I'm eating at great restaurants. But I'm not at home. I'm not with my partner. I'm on the road. Like, I'm not connected from what grounds me.
You're outside of your community, mm-hmm. basically.
Outside of my community. And you know, I always feel ungrateful when I say that I'm not feeling well. You know, and like that, and that takes a strain because, like, my partner can kind of shoulder a little bit of the burden because, you know, we love each other and, like, that's easy. But, you know, to anyone else, they're like, oh, you're just complaining. Like, you have the best job in the world. And I do.
Right.
But like, please, like, it's also stressful. Like, my body is taking, like, I'm taking a beating.
Right.
You know, I'm sick all the time. Like,
and, you know, and it's interesting because you do cover restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. And it is exciting to be invited to places and have the tasting menus. And, you know, like, everything is, like, the best that a restaurant has to offer or even a city has to offer. But at the same time, you know, those wine pairings, they come with a cost. You know, the being out, just even being out late, but just even consuming the food.
Yeah, I cover drinks and cocktails and wine. Like, that's my specialty. And I have to say no so much. And I just don't say, I don't agree to tasting menus anymore. I'm like, no. Like,
it's too much.
It's so much.
Yeah. One of my favorite things, I'll leave names of restaurant, names of people out of this story. But I went to a very nice restaurant, huge tasting menu. And we left and I turned to my boss at the time and I said, so what'd you think? And he said, I'd rather go to a pig roast. And I said, yeah, I get it.
That sounds delicious, actually. Yeah, exactly. Like, just give me, you know, some just protein just sometimes. Like
that, yeah. Relaxing, you know,
yeah.
Comfort food.
Yeah, because I had my pie for breakfast. So I really don't need anything extra throughout the day. I need salads from breakfast on.
Yeah, and part of it, too, is I also really love to cook. And, like, cooking for me is so meditative. And when I'm not on... when I'm not home, not doing that, like, I just feel really unmoored.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's something that I'm working through. But it is so much about, I'm learning as I get older, like, what makes me feel secure. And a lot of that is, you know, finding routines that I can bring with me. But that's still a journey that I'm on.
Right. And I think it's kind of like you said, like, figuring out, like, what self-care means to you. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you take care of your body, of your mind, of your spirit, even if you have a job that, you know, from the outside is very, it's very fancy, it's very desirable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just kind of lean, like, first of all, identifying those things and then leaning into those things. And I think just giving yourself the grace sometimes, like, you know what, you can complain about having gone to, like, a fabulous party or dinner or whatever, because if you need that space, I think you have to just kind of take it. And, you know, I think it's interesting also, Joseph, you mentioned that, like, cooking grounds you.
Yeah, I loved that.
Yeah.
You said that.
And, you know, Janet, I'm curious because mm-hmm. as a recipe developer,
yeah,
you know, that's your job sometimes,
yes,
is cooking. Do you feel that you're able to kind of, like,
yes,
I know you love to bake.
Yes, I do.
but are you able to go to that, like, happy place that I'm sure drew you to this field in the first place?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, when I first started recipe developing, I remember just, like, taking the olive oil and throwing it in the pan. I was like, oh, I have to measure it, you know. And so for when I recipe develop, I have to be precise and that. But my vacation is thrown, you know, no measuring. I just cook and make something on the fly, and that's sort of my therapy for having improv cooking to sort of make up for the precision cooking, which is a wonderful thing too. The only thing that's bad about when I do the improvisational cooking is something will come out really, really good. And then I'm like, oh, I wish I'd measured all of those ingredients because this is so good.
Right.
But oh well.
Yeah.
And maybe also like a benefit with improv cooking, I imagine, is if something doesn't come out how you want or expect, like it doesn't even matter. Like it's fine.
Yeah.
Whereas like when you're, well, when I'm developing recipes, it's, you know, it's a little disheartening sometimes where it's like, well, this is the third time I've made this and I don't want to make it again. And yep. I still haven't gotten to where I'm trying to go. So that's something I've struggled with, right?
Because you're also taking notes as you're doing that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I've kind of struggled with like, you know, my happy place being in the kitchen and I do love to measure. You know, that balance of like, well, I need to finish developing recipes for this project or for my cookbook. But at the same time, like, it's Thanksgiving and I just want to make, you know, I just want to make a pecan pie, like freestyle for the people who love me and who want this pie. So
when do you, just out of curiosity, when do you give up when you're working on a recipe? How many times do you do it before you just like?
I've always wondered that when you're just like, this is good enough.
Yeah, this is good enough.
Or this is a failure.
I'm throwing it in my drawer and maybe I'll bring it out another time when I can maybe think about it differently or, yeah, it's.
That's a great question, Janet. Thank you for posing
it. But it has nothing to do with what we're talking about
today.
No.
I'm so glad you asked this question because, you know, it's interesting. I've come to realize I'm a perfectionist, which is ironic because like I'm also really all over the place, like can't keep to a schedule. But like when I get my mindset on something, I kind of have tunnel vision. So there was a recipe I was trying to work through in August because I had this vision and I was like, this is going to be awesome. It's, you know, this is for the cookbook. I made this recipe and it was a pie of sorts. I probably made it 10 times. And you know, I have other pies in the book that I need to, you know, perfect and write, etc. And I finally got to a place where I was like, "Oh, I'm just setting it aside. Like I have not yet acknowledged that this might not work. It's still just like sitting on the side like I'm going to go back to it. I don't know. I might need to just like send it to, you know, a recipe doctor.
Yeah.
This is my vision. This is what I've been doing. Like, what is the problem? Because I'm pretty good at like being able to like figure out what's wrong and fix it. And, but I think that there's just something inside of me that wants to like get that A plus
Do you think you're still too close to it? I feel that way about writing so many times that I'm like, I just have to set it aside and then like look at it as if I didn't write it.
Yeah. Oh, so that's fresh eyes.
Fresh eyes. Yeah.
That's a very good question. Cause part of me is really contemplating like tossing it, but that like overachiever person is like, oh no, like we will not accept failure. That is failure. And we will not accept that. But no, with writing, that's definitely a different struggle, but the same, right? So it's like the question of like, well, when is this ready? And I'm like, well, when it's due.
Oh.
Well, I think that's one of the things too. You know, when I was working in magazines, sometimes you just didn't have much time. You had to like slam this stuff out fast, and so you know you had to make it as best as you could. And I feel like I did a really good job with that. And I learned how to be very, very fast.
Yeah. I mean, in a newsroom, for sure.
Like, right. You just got to pound that stuff out.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, I was always, like, God bless copy editors.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yes.
God bless fact checkers.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
It does take a village. And unfortunately, those jobs are disappearing, too. But
it's kind of scary.
But, like, I knew that.
It's not good.
When you could produce something and you're like, you just know that you need another pair of eyes. Like, it's always good for that. But you do have to just pound it out and get it out.
Yeah.
And publish it before, especially, you know, from a newspaper standpoint, like, we didn't want to get scooped. And
right.
we knew what other people were working on. Like, that's a very different environment from a magazine, because you're not necessarily scooping people
right.
on things. It's just that you don't want to look like the follower.
Right, absolutely. Right? Or even just at when something is still newsworthy.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with more from Janet and Joseph.
My name is Paul Willis. I'm a fifth generation hog farmer, and I owned and operated the Willis Free Range Pig Farm for over 41 years. I've dedicated my life to revitalizing sustainable hog farming methods in the Midwest and moving farms away from the common industrial practices. In 1998, I established the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. I'm proud to say Nyman Ranch has since grown into a network of over 740 independent family farmers and ranchers today. At Nyman Ranch, our animals are raised with care. We believe that the quality of an animal's life impacts the quality of the meat. Our high standards were developed with the help of animal welfare expert, Dr. Temple Grandin, and are among the strictest in the industry. All of our animals live outdoors or in deeply bedded pens, and they're never given antibiotics or added hormones ever, and are only fed a high-quality 100% vegetarian diet. Whether they're raising hogs, cattle, or lamb, Nyman Ranch farmers and ranchers share our commitment to traditional farming, raising livestock in the way our parents and grandparents did, and supporting our rural communities. We share a common belief that humane and sustainable methods produce the best possible flavor. Learn more about our work at Nyman Ranch at NymanRanch.com.
Hi, and we are back with Janet McCracken, a freelance editor and recipe developer, and Joseph Hernandez, a freelance editor and writer. So I kind of wanted to pivot the conversation a little bit and talk a little bit more about the cost of staying relevant and what that means in this age of social media and, you know, so many like events and conferences and food festivals. It seems like, you know, every month there's a new big major food festival that's popping up. And, you know, as a freelancer, it's important to stay abreast of these things. And, you know, whether you consider yourself, you know, a writer or editor or influencer, people have to know that you're out there. So you have to be tweeting, you have to be posting on Instagram, and all of that takes time, and or even giving people content away for free. I mean, Joseph, you're a pretty frequent tweeter. Mm-hmm. Does that feel like work to you, or is that something that, you know, you would be doing anyway?
I have a complicated relationship with Twitter. I'm finding myself less and less enthused about being on it. A lot because of, you know, the current state of things in the world and just, you know, being distracted by a lot of noise. But also, like, being distracted, you know, like, coming off of a few staff jobs and feeling the pull of Twitter for quote-unquote research, and like that false positive of I'm doing this for work. I'm finding now as a freelancer is a lie that I was telling myself instead of actually just doing the work. I'm you know, kind of confronting why I use it and when I use it and how I use it. And I still use it in a way to connect with fellow writers, fellow editors, and kind of seeing what the conversation is. But I do find myself relying on my own counsel now, as opposed to logging in. And a lot of that has to do with, like, I've set up a lot of app blockers and Chrome extensions that just, like, shut down Twitter when I go to it, which is great.
Oh, wow.
So.
I mean, yeah, no, and it's interesting. You point out there is so much happening in the world right now, like the news cycle, 24-hour news cycle. There's Twitter with cancel culture and hashtags that are constantly happening. You know, is when you say it's distracting in a way, do you mean that maybe, you know, the food conversation where it's an argument over like an Aperol spritz is like, it can't really stand next to the events happening in the world? Or Jana, I see you laughing. Do you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, I think that is a really great point. But then again, perhaps the Aperol spritz controversy is a welcome relief also from everything that's going on.
And for those who don't know, there was an article, I think a few months ago.
Beginning of summer
about Aperol spritz, and it just became an issue where people were on one side or the other of we hate them or they're okay.
They're really a stupid drink, or I don't care, I like how it tastes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it just became a very big conversation, which, like you said, like maybe it is a welcome break that we need.
Yeah.
But
it is kind of silly at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So I've been reading a lot of like just non-food work lately, partly to kind of reorient myself. You know, I was laid off very recently and I've been in the freelance game for a little over a month, and just kind of reestablishing where I get my ideas from, that kind of thing, because it's one thing to work on a publication on staff and knowing what you have to produce versus now I'm the producing engine and I just need to refill my well. Part of my like kind of rejiggering of my relationship with Twitter reread a book by the writer and illustrator Austin Kleon, and he has this idea about stock and flow, where stock is the big stuff that we work on, our big ideas, our essays, our journals, the things that like we really sit down and kind of work on over time and really develop and one day we'll hopefully introduce to the world. And then flow are the things that we just kind of fire off in the timeline, and the timeline of Facebook, the timeline of social media, of Instagram and Twitter, and how the idea of flow, because we hit publish quickly, fools us into thinking that we did work. And there's an idea that like we're contributing to the flow of another person's timeline. We're contributing our ideas. How many ideas do we tweet thread? And it is now on Twitter, instead of taking that idea and turning it into stock that becomes a story idea, that becomes a feature, that becomes a profile, that becomes a larger body of work that really you can then produce into a book or sell to an editor. And really that's kind of changed my idea of how I tweet.
I love that. I'm going to use that. I'm going to keep that in the back of my mind.
Thanks. Stock my and idea. Flow. Awesome. Yeah.
but that's wonderful.
I love that also. And I think I kind of struggle with this because, you know, my platform du choix is Instagram. Mm-hmm. And Instagram, it appears to me, you know, you are rewarded for frequency. Mm-hmm. And it's not just frequency on the feed or stories or ID. It's like all of them. And so part of me feels this pressure, like I must continue to post. Otherwise, I just like disappear into the ether and I won't pop up on people's feeds when I do have something that I'm ready to share with them, that I'm really excited that I've done the gold star work and put in the stock and all of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's like another thing. I think, you know, Twitter is great in a way that like, yes, tweets that get engagement are promoted, but there's still that chronological timeline that happens. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, that people at least have a chance to see your stuff. Whereas with Facebook and Instagram, you know, it's a little different right now. as to whether or not you'll even pop up on someone's feed. Mm-hmm. I guess it is different with stories in a sense, mm-hmm. because they're all there at the top. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's tough because I think we were talking about this earlier, being freelance now. It's like I suddenly feel more pressure to be sure it's like, oh my God, I better post because I need to be sure I stay out there and stay relevant and people don't think I, you know, gone off to Timbuktu or
right.
whatever.
It's like she's moved upstate and has opened a bread and breakfast. Yeah, right.
that's never going to happen. But I do think, and I don't do Twitter and I feel guilty about it. But then you're making me feel so much better. But I think.
But you're on Instagram.
I am on Instagram and Facebook, and I do enjoy it. I do like, you know, I don't spend a lot of time on it, but I do love dipping in every now and then to kind of look around on what people are up to. And like also what you're saying, it's interesting to see what people are doing. I think mm-hmm. who you follow is really important, mm-hmm. and it's seeing what people are up to. What are people making? What are trends? I love it when I get an idea, like, oh, what a great idea. So I do think it's of value, mm-hmm. but I think placing your value in it is when it gets a little tricky.
Right.
Right. And I think there's so much still to be said about, I think social media exacerbates the comparison game, you know? What is that person doing? What are the, you know, am I as good as them? Am I not? Like, it really feeds into that. And I don't know about y'all, but like that does really affect me. And that's a thing that, you know, me and my therapist love to talk about.
Right.
why do they have 24,000 followers?
Right. Right. And you know, I'm getting over like the following game thing. Cause it's never right. going to happen for me, but and I don't care.
Opportunities, but like, maybe, that right. you see other people getting.
Well I think that it does matter because people that do have the followers are much more likely to get cookbook deals.
That's a really
good
point.
So, I mean, it does matter, mm-hmm. sadly.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's more like, where do they get that idea? Like, how do I do that? And Valerie, to your point about like staying relevant, it's like, oh, like that was a really good idea and that makes me really jealous. And figuring out coping with that jealousy and then just figuring out a way to do that work also. Because I do think that, you know, we were talking about how there's so much shift happening in this space right now. I think there is room for everyone. I'm not a complete, you know, cynic about the current food media space. I think there is room for everybody and room for all these voices. It's just, where is my voice?
Right.
And like, and that's just always been my thing as a writer is like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Like,
but you do.
I know.
but no, I love what you said because the consumers want to, like, people want to consume food media. Like that's like, I'm not going to say it's ironic, but like, that's an amazing thing for all of us. Like people love, whether it's like the more infotainment, right? Versus like inspirational versus like, this is really practical. And this is something that I'm going to do at home. Like all of it, it's all there for us. And people love consuming it. And it's not just food, right? Like there's like so much content and it's everywhere. It's all of the streaming devices and it's every, like it's entertainment, it's music, it's everything. Like the doors are wide open. And in a way that's really exciting because, you know, some of those more traditional gatekeepers, you know, I'm not going to say they're gone, but they've, it's just a different pathway, I think, for entry.
Yeah. It's like when I was a kid, I'll show my age here, there were three television stations. And you had three choices of programming to watch. Now there are so many choices. And it's the same in food media. It at the same time, you get more opportunity, but at the same time, it's overwhelming. It's like, you know, you mentioned something like a magazine, I've never heard of that, or a website, or a podcast. There's so much out there to consume, it's hard to, you know, wade through it.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I wonder, I'm like, will there be like movie stars or as we know them, or like, you know, that TV show that everyone was watching at the same time? Like, what will that look like in 5 years? Mm. Will we have that, like those frames of reference that, you know,
that like universal cultural touch point?
Yeah.
Like everybody knew like whatever, Saved by the Bell or
exactly. Or will it be more in terms of like virality? Like, oh, remember when that meme of the woman yelling at the cat took over Facebook for 5 whole days? Like,
right.
Is that going to be our point of reference? Because
let's hope not.
Yeah.
That example.
It's amorphous.
Yes, exactly. And yeah. That's the example I gave is quite frivolous. It's, right. It's, so I don't know. But so Janet, you know, you have an interesting background. You were living in LA, you were an actress, mm-hmm. you became a mom, you taught part-time, substitute teaching rather,
yep.
and you decided you wanted to go into the food industry, mm-hmm. and so you went to culinary school.
I did.
You ended up working for the LA Times, which
yes.
is amazing.
It was great.
Yeah, it was great.
It was great, yes.
What was so great about it? Because
well,
I believe you when you said
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the first... I knew I wanted to be a food editor. That was what I knew I wanted to do. And I knew I had to get cred. So I went to culinary school. And I knew that the only place in LA to get at work, there were two places, Bon Appetit, because Bon Appetit used to be in LA.
Bi-coastal.
And then the Los Angeles Times. And Bon Appetit didn't take interns, but the LA Times did. And I really pushed for it and I got it. And it was a combination of learning. That's where I really learned how to be a recipe tester. And I also got a tremendous opportunity to get a lot of stuff in print. So when I left, I actually had a portfolio, mm-hmm. which was a huge gift. And I ended up doing more smaller articles for them, as well as a couple of cover stories for them. And it was invaluable. Invaluable.
Right. Awesome. Yeah. So, I mean... obviously, you went on, you became
Then I moved to the other joint in town.
Yes.
Bon Appetit.
Yes.
Yes.
And eventually, Rachel Ray Every Day.
Mm-hmm.
But what's next?
Oh, boy. You know, that's what I'm wondering right now. You know, I'm trying to figure out my stock right mm-hmm. now as I produce
that.
Some flow, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out, like, you know, I would love to start working on cookbooks, you know, maybe work with someone on producing a cookbook. Because coming up with a cookbook, as you know, it takes a lot of time to do the proposal and get everything together. It will take a couple of years. So to be able to work on other projects that are happening right now, I would love to do that. I'd love to write articles for things. You know, I'm really trying to figure out. Here I am, folks. I'm ready.
Where can
ready
they,
and
where
available.
Where can people find you, Janet?
Yep. Janet, my email?
Whatever you want to share.
Oh, well, you can always contact me through Instagram or Facebook. Janet McCracken at both places.
You guys can slide into her DMs.
Joseph,
please slide into her DMs. Joseph, what about you? Like, where, like, given your background, where do you see the direction that you're in? What do you like about what you're doing right now? You know, doing freelance writing, and where do you kind of see it going?
I love the freedom of freelance writing. Like, I love kind of the control I have of my day. Thing I hate about it is that it's too much potential, too much to focus on, and so that's kind of me having to reestablish a new discipline, which is interesting and a good challenge, and I'm kind of enjoying it right now, so that's fine. I'd love to get back on staff in a newsroom. I just really love the energy. We were talking about this earlier, just the energy of working with other creative people and really just bouncing ideas off everyone and just kind of polishing the final product. I love that stage of something.
Me too.
Yeah. And, and you know, we were talking a little bit about it. You had touched points on, like, you know, indie magazines and podcasts and things, and just kind of how the food space has blown up. I recently just took some podcasting classes just to kind of, you know, recharge myself and pick up some new skills, because I think that in order to stay relevant, you should know what's happening in the space. And, you know, I've come from, like I said, newspapers, magazines, digital, and each time I had to pick up new ways to produce the content that I love.
Yeah, I think podcasts, I'm also interested in exploring that to some degree. I think it's a really interesting media platform.
Yeah. And I love what you said, Joseph, about, you know, it's just one more tool to put in your toolkit so that mm-hmm. you can essentially be a journalist and be a storyteller, mm-hmm. right? It's just all different ways that we're doing this, whether it's through, you know, the flow of tweets and quick social media content, or the more gold star work of, you know, a thoughtful essay or book proposal or manuscript, right? Mm-hmm.
What I love about podcasts, especially in the food space right now, is that there's so much less. I mean, obviously you're editing podcasts too, but like you're letting the subject speak their own story directly. And I think that that's such a beautiful thing. They come off a little bit more. My favorite stories that I've ever written were always based on really honest interviews with people. And I think that podcasts capture that moment perfectly.
I agree. And I think the other thing I wanted to say, both, you know, podcasting, writing, cookbooks, whatever, I just want to keep learning, you know, like mm-hmm. that's the thing that is the most fun, is keeping on learning, keeping up on whether it's just information, a new technique, a higher thinking concept, just to keep alive, you know?
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think that, you know, that like creative part in each of you, that, you know, probably brought you into this field is what's going to keep us all here also. So we normally close things up with some rapid fire questions. No, we keep these really fun and quick. So we'll just take like a quick minute or two. Janet, you look scared. Okay, so you're first. Favorite Christmas time, like food specialty.
Oh.
Or any holiday.
Well, Christmas, I love to make cookies.
That's a great answer.
Okay.
'Tis the season for holiday cookie parties, yeah. The cookie swaps.
Yes, right? I love a cookie swap.
Joseph, mm-hmm. favorite winter vegetable.
Okay. I'll tell, because I just had it like four times this week. Radicchio.
Oh,
like love radicchio.
Oh,
give me that bitter, bitter purple. Like,
see, I cannot handle the bitter.
Oh man, with like a fatty, warm vinaigrette.
Mm. I'm not doing it right. That's the problem,
yeah.
huh?
Yeah.
Fat and acid.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. All right. One more question for you, Joseph. Mm-hmm. Favorite winter cocktail.
Manhattan.
Hi.
Manhattan.
We're in Brooklyn. Is that okay? Manhattan okay. up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'll take one next time you're here on our podcast.
I'll bring it a batch of it.
Yeah. And Janet, one more follow up for you. What cookie will you be making for any cookie swaps this year?
Oh, well, I make this one every year. It ran in Food and Wine years and years and years ago. It was a Pierre Hermé cookie.
And, love him. Sorry.
Oh, my God.
Love him.
And it's relatively easy. It's like a super, super thin shortbread layer. And then it's a Florentine, like a caramel, honey, nuts, orange zest, orange juice layer. And you bake that. And then you put chocolate on top. Oh, no. You don't put chocolate on top. You put nuts on top. And then you cut it into triangles and dip the corners in. Mm. They're just extraordinary. And you can make them ahead and freeze them. So, yes. Like, you can make them now, throw them in the freezer, and bring them out whenever you want them.
That's my favorite thing about winter cookies. Just, like, start doing it now. Freeze the dough.
There's one more. My mother's apricot bars. That's another one that's really, really, really good.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That feels very important to mention.
Oh,
Gotta, you know, pay homage to
the moms.
Where these recipes all came from. Yeah. All right. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And you can find Joseph on Twitter and Instagram at JoeyBear85. And you can find Janet at Janet McCracken on Facebook and Instagram. You can find me on Instagram at Foodie in New York or my website, foodieinnewyork.com. And thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you guys next week. Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.